This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us on what is a nice fall Sunday. There's no buffalo snow. There's no freezing cold temperatures making your steps slick and dangerous. This is 91.9 and Crozet and the Valley's 101.1. We want to welcome our guest today is Professor Sidney Milkus. Welcome.
Thanks, Rex. Always good to be back with you.
Well, thank you. I hope you don't mind, but I announced everybody. We promoted you a couple weeks ago as being the guest. And so several times throughout the hour, for those who were turning in and couldn't figure out what we were doing, I hope you're feeling better. I announced everybody to send you good wishes and good thoughts.
Yeah, I am feeling better. A little cold, but it's great to be here.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to do so. For those who aren't sure what in the world we're going to be talking about, I'm always fascinated. It's been a year of politics. Of course, it always seems to be a time of politics in this nation, but so much of it is back and forth and accusatory. And sometimes it's good to look at it from where we are now and look back. And I'm regularly fascinated by what happened then and how it affects today. So we're going to do this in a little more historical aspect with Professor Milkus. He is a professor of politics at the University of Virginia, as well as being a faculty associate at the Miller Center of Public Affairs. So history and politics, that's your thing?
Yep. And I think that's fair.
Yeah. And I want to look at some of these elections that these days, I think some of the more obvious ones, like if you want to talk about 1860 and Lincoln and slavery, or 1789 when George Washington becomes president. Oh, yeah, I know what happened with that. I know why that was important. But sometimes some of these you're like, oh, who won then? And why is that important? So that's what we're going to be doing for the hour with Professor Sidney Milkus. So, Professor, I put these in an order of my own.
Good. Well, that way I won't get confused.
but if we run across one and you're like, you know, let's
back up.
This is a good one to touch on too while we're on this one now. Okay. But I wanted to start off. The first one seemed to be good both for our community and in terms of historical aspect is the election of 1796.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
This is when Thomas Jefferson becomes president.
Vice President. John Adams.
So talk about why this is important.
Yeah, this is important, Rick, because the first 8 years of under the Constitution, George Washington was president. And he was incredibly popular, considered almost a patriot king in the United States, and elected twice unanimously to the presidency. But during Washington's presidency, some conflict began to develop, led by Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, mostly over the creation of a national bank, a very powerful institution that Hamilton had created, that Jefferson thought was unconstitutional and dangerous centralization of power. So even though Washington tried to rise above that conflict, he and his vice president, John Adams, sort of sided with Hamilton and what became known as the Federalist position. Thomas Jefferson and his followers became known as Democratic Republicans to distinguish them from the Republicans, which we'll talk about when we get up to the Civil War period. So by the time we get to 1796, Rick, there's a division between the Federalists, now led by John Adams, because Washington refuses to run for a third term and establishes that two-term tradition, and Thomas Jefferson and the Democratic Republicans. And there's a question, as you and I were talking about before we went on the air, about whether the United States would be able to go through an electoral transformation where Washington was no longer at the helm. So what happens is John Adams is elected president, and Thomas Jefferson is elected vice president. Now, that sounds strange to our listeners, but the reason for that is in the original Constitution, there was no way to form a party ticket or vote for a party ticket. So it's what the electors did, or electoral college, is they selected two people for the presidency. And the person who came in first became the president, and the person who came in second became the vice president. So it would be fun if this happened still. We'd have President Obama as our president and Mitt Romney as our vice president. And that would make things even more delicious than they are currently.
I mean, where would that go in terms of stagnation, do you believe?
Well, it didn't really. It's a good question. There was kind of a holding pattern from 1796 to 1800 when Jefferson is elected president in his own right. But I think what we would the way we would describe that today is sort of partisan gridlock. There was still a great deal of fighting over things like the National Bank and also foreign affairs, because Adams and the Federalists were closer to the British. And Jefferson and his political ally, Madison, were closer to the French. So there was kind of a deadlock and a battle over these issues, which are kind of resolved in the election of 1800, when parties really get organized and Thomas Jefferson becomes president. John Adams goes home bitterly. Adams and Jefferson were good friends, Rick. But political conflict between them sort of ended that friendship. Adams went home before Jefferson was inaugurated, and they never spoke again.
Many people are good friends until you start talking about politics.
Right. You and I are good friends, but if we ran against each other.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't asked you what your thoughts are on certain sensitive topics.
So Jefferson called that the Revolution of 1800 because it really put his party and the principles he believed in, which was kind of a decentralized republic, into power.
And the election of 1796 shows that democracy can work. There is no battle about Washington stepping down and there's some sort of physical warlike fight about who's going to take over power. Or there's no knighting of Jefferson's kin to take this place. This is democracy in its first fledgling steps, right?
That's right. And you know, we take it for granted now that there'll be a peaceful transfer of power, but there was real questions about whether it was possible in the early parts of the republic, which was still very fragile and very divided on fundamental grounds. So when Adams replaced Washington in 1796, Rick, you're right, that was a big deal. What's even a bigger deal is when an opposition party, so to speak, Jefferson and the Democratic Republicans come in 1800, and that's done peacefully. I would say that's the first peaceful transfer of power, that is an opposition party coming in to govern in the world, not just in the United States.
11:07 here on the Wake Up Call, talking about important elections in throughout American history, sometimes overlooked because it didn't stand for Lincoln and slavery, or it wasn't George Washington starting up the country, or it wasn't Barack Obama being the first African-American president, or Kennedy being the first Catholic president. But a lot of these are fascinating because of where they lead us today and what they stood for at the time. Professor Sidney Milkus from the University of Virginia. So let's move on to the one that you identified as being key in many, many different ways, which is the election of 1912.
Wow, we really jumped. We're time travelers.
Yes, well, hey, isn't that really cool, though? I like that part. We're going to be time traveling.
I like your boldness, Rick. We just hurtled through history.
We'll go back and forth. I'll try not to get dizzy.
Yeah. So we're into the 20th century, and I've always, as we talked about, I won't promote it on the air, but I wrote a book about
it. Can you find it on Amazon?
You can find it on Amazon, yeah. Just Google. Just go on Amazon and put my name in under author, and it'll pop up. It's called the Theodore Roosevelt, the Progressive Party, and the Transformation of American Democracy.
Now, I listed it down as important because of the strong influence that the third party candidate had.
Yeah.
But you mentioned it for a couple other reasons. So let's just jump in and talk about this.
Well, I do think, you know, my students oftentimes will tell me, you know, they're tempted to vote for maybe the Libertarian Party or back a few years ago, the Ralph Nader's Green Party. But it's a waste of a vote to vote for a third party. So there's a couple of elections I can point to belie that notion. History helps me here, Rick. So the first really important third party is the Republican Party that emerges in the 1850s as a kind of anti-slavery party, and Lincoln becomes the first Republican, president. That emerged as a third party in the 1850s, and it replaced, we were talking about this obscure Whigs Party. It replaces the Whigs Party, and then it becomes the Democrats and Republicans after that. And until the Industrial Revolution and the issues shift from like slavery and Reconstruction to the Industrial Revolution and how we're to deal with this new animal called a corporation, the Republicans were kind of thought of as the Progressive Party, the Democrats thought of as sort of the reactionary party. Well, all of that comes unhinged in 1912, which is a fight mainly over what to do with the corporation. And Theodore Roosevelt, who had served two terms and then gone off to Africa to hunt, came back to the United States in 1910, restless. He was still pretty young, and he wanted to be president again. And his heir apparent, William Howard Taft, in the Republican, who was the Republican incumbent president, was, he thought, not living up to his legacy. So he challenged him for the nomination of the Republican Party in 1912. In fact, Rick, this is the first time we have a primary contest in a presidential election. Before this, all the power lay with the National Party Convention and the delegates elected.
How did they do that? I mean, is the primary system significantly different today than it was then? Or did they just say, oh, I want to run, and they went around the country identifying who would be the best candidate?
It's been extended today from what happens in 1912. Before 1912, the conventions are made up of delegates who are selected by the state and local parties. These are party activists. Roosevelt challenged the party establishment, so to speak, saying that they prevented the people from speaking about who the presidential candidate should be.
That could still be said today.
So he champions the popular primary. Because of his championing it, they're expanded, so we have 12 important ones in 1912. And he wins 8 of them and badly defeats Taft, even in Taft's home state of Ohio, by about a 3-2 margin. And in spite of that, will of the people expressing itself in the primaries, Roosevelt is denied the nomination by the party leaders, who want nothing to do with Roosevelt now, in 1912 as an insurgent challenge to the way they want to do things. And so he bolts. Being denied the nomination, he bolts from the Republican Party, and he becomes the standard bearer of a new progressive party.
Properly named.
Yes, properly named. This is the precursor to the Democratic Party we know now, which really took shape during the New Deal and the Great Society. But all the causes that the Democratic Party has championed since the 1930s are championed first by the Progressive Party of 1912. And Roosevelt says at some point in talking to the press, which he loved to do, that he felt strong as a bull moose. Now, many of your, I guess some of our audience know what a bull moose, but it's a male moose. And this became known as the Bull Moose Campaign of 1912.
So a little stronger and a little more feisty than Rocky.
Yeah, that's right. Roosevelt's famous line in his speeches.
Or Bullwinkle.
A little stronger than Rocky.
Bullwinkle the moose, Rocky the flying squirrel.
Yeah.
I should know that.
We're aging ourselves. Wow. We know that. Remember Natasha?
Oh, yes. I have several books from the whole cartoon and video collection of Bullwinkle.
To show the importance of that campaign, a little more religious refrain, Roosevelt's famous line is, "We stand at Armageddon, and we battle for the Lord." And that he thought everything was up for grabs in that election. Most importantly, whether or not the corporations were to remain an independent power free of the government at a time when they were really dominating the economy and even the government, or whether the government in the voice of the people, with the voice of the people behind them, were to begin to take control of the corporation and make it serve as much as possible the public interest.
So when the election comes about, Roosevelt is a potential candidate on the ballot.
He's on the ballot, and also the progressives have a full ticket, so they run people at every level of government, including members of candidates for
Congress. He obviously doesn't win.
He doesn't win. He comes in second. And he comes. Do you want me to say who? I thought you were, which one of us is going to say who won that election? Woodrow Wilson. Because the Republicans split, allows what's then the minority party with their standard bearer, Woodrow Wilson, to win the election of 1912. And Wilson ran also as a progressive, although a little bit more moderate version of progressive than Roosevelt, but still supported a progressive program.
Do you think, looking back, is this the first and the last, or how long has it been since 1912 when a third party candidate in a national campaign actually changed the outcome?
Yeah. Well, it's possible that that Perot,
Clinton, HR,
and Bush 41, Bush Senior. It's possible in that 1992 election that Perot, who won 18% of the vote, may have prevented President Bush from being reelected,
and because everyone got under 50%, correct?
Exactly. But what I would say about 1912, Rick, is this is the last time you have a full blown third party with a full slate of candidates operating in an important way in American politics. After this, we have important third independent candidates running, but not a full blown third party challenge, which can really change the nature of American politics in a really enduring way, not just in effect an election.
UVA professor of politics Sidney Milk is here with us today. We're talking
about. Can I say one thing about 1912? The other thing that's always interested me about that campaign is that this is also the high point of the Socialist Party, and Eugene Debs is a fourth candidate in this campaign, and he wins 6% of the vote, and this is the high point for socialists. So this is the best. Showing that the Socialist Party under Eugene Debs, who was very popular at the time, makes in 1912. And I've always argued that because the socialists were pretty popular, people were thinking they would become the alternative to the Democrats rather than something like a progressive or liberal version of reform. Had Roosevelt not run in 1912, then I think the socialists might have emerged as a much more important a force in American politics throughout the 20th century. Kind of stole their thunder.
And we're just going back and forth in time, not other dimensions.
Let's get back in our time. Right, that's one of my favorite movies. Remember The Time Machine with Robert Taylor?
Yeah,
let's hope we don't see the warlocks in our journey.
before we change, go too far in time, Scott from Charlottesville had a couple questions. One is, wants to know whether a third party will ever emerge, or will they always be incorporated into existing parties?
Yeah, that's a great question, Scott. And my students ask me this all the time. And I thought there might be room for a third party now. It seems like there's a lot of interest in candidates who would be liberal on social issues, think immigration, and conservative on financial issues, particularly regarding budgetary matters. The thing that makes it difficult for third parties now are campaign finance laws, which begin to really take shape in the 1970s, which make it much more difficult to be formed than was the case before those laws were passed. And the other thing is we now have primaries. So, these begin in 1912, but in the late 60s, that becomes the major way to get the nomination for the presidency. And with primaries, insurgents don't have to form a third party. They can just enter the primary contest and try to have their influence in that way. So we can still have important third party candidates. It's possible that a libertarian candidate could get 4 or 5% of the vote and influence the 2016 election. But most of the challenges now, rather than through third parties, occur through primaries.
All right. And Scott also wanted to take a moment and remind everybody that every vote counts. He's seen several elections where the decision has come down to just one vote.
Yeah, and I think 2000 would tell us that, wouldn't it?
Right, yes, 2000.
Yeah.
As well as, I mean, just this recent vote.
Right,
The post-election metrics show that the reason that Mark Warner had such a close outcome versus the Republican Gillespie was that a very large percentage of Democrats who kept saying that they would vote for Mark Warner didn't go to the polls.
Right. And that I forget the final tally on that election, but it was extremely close.
Well, it was less than 1%.
Less than 1%.
I think it was like 14,000 or so, maybe.
Something like 12,000 to 14,000. And we often think that one vote, what does that matter? If we do rational calculations, it doesn't make any sense to take time to go to the polls. But I really appreciate Scott's point. And not only is it can it be very important, as the Warner re-election shows and the 2000 presidential election shows, it's also something that citizens need to do. I mean, we were talking about the early part of the republic, and a lot of our citizens didn't have the vote at that time, and they fought for the vote, women and African Americans. And so this is not just a privilege, this is a right, and we should exercise that right.
11:20 here on the Wake Up Call, talking with our guest today.
When you're flying through time, it goes really quick.
Professor Sidney Milk is here. Call up with your question. Mallory will take your question and pass it along. 434-979-0919. We need to do some work. Be right back.
Support today for WNRN comes from
Alakazam Toys, stocking thousands of specialty products to choose from, including creative and imaginative playthings, games, and puzzles for all ages. Alakazam is on the downtown mall in Charlottesville. Information at alakazamtoys.com.
Lexington Rockbridge Area Tourism, where you can celebrate a small-town Christmas at Lexington's Candlelight Processional and Tree Lighting on Friday, November 28th, and Buena Vista's Christmas Parade and Holiday Lights in the Park on December 4th. Information at lexingtonvirginia.com.
The Modlin Center for the Arts at the University of Richmond, presenting comedian Paula Poundstone on December 5th at 7 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. and The Lone Bellow with special guest Robert Ellis on Saturday, December 6th at 7:30 p.m. Details are at modlin.richmond.edu.
T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing. T&N Printing can be reached at t-nprinting.com.
Commonwealth Reserve, Commonwealth Skybar's new private event space. From food and bar menus to floor plans, every detail is customizable. Commonwealth Reserve for business meetings, presentations, receptions, luncheons, and dinners. Commonwealth Reserve's event planner can tailor events from 20 to 100 guests. You can book your event at CommonwealthReserve.com.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being with us today. It's a beautiful Sunday out there. And it took the time to make it down here, University of Virginia, Professor of Politics, Sidney Milkus, also a faculty associate at the Miller Center of Public Affairs. We'll be recording this. We'll put it up as podcast so that when you want to go back and take notes on what happened when, so you get your historical information correct, when you start talking to people during your holiday parties, you want to seem all smart.
Buy my book as a present for your relatives.
Amazon.com.
I'll sign it, Rick.
Professor Sidney Milkus, that's M-I-L-K-I-S.
There you go.
For those who want to type in the author's name correctly. So let's jump back in our time machine. And there's back-to-back elections that each have their own significance. It seems as though one comes up because of certain issues, which leads to a vital change in the next.
Yeah.
The election of 1824, I have it down here. It's known as the corrupt bargain because of what happened. Talk about that.
Yeah, boy, we could spend the rest of the show on this election, but I'll try to summarize it in an uncharacteristic brevity. What happened is the Democratic Republicans had triumphed over the Federalists by 1820. In 1812 to 1820, there isn't any party conflict. It's known as the era of good feelings. Never has a period been so misnamed.
Let's cut and paste that into today.
Because very soon, Rick, the Democratic Republicans fragment. Into individual and factional
rivalries.
Right,
because at that point it's one party.
It's one
party. The Democratic Republic Party.
Right. So just imagine if we just had the Republicans now and you had battles between these Tea Party candidates and the more establishment candidates. And that's kind of what 1824 looked like. The year of good feelings decidedly comes to an end. And the formal Democratic nominee, but then the nominations are made by the Congressional Caucus, the party members within the Congress, and they nominate William Crawford from Georgia, who had been Secretary of State, and this had been like the stepping stone to the presidency under the Jeffersonians. Like James Madison was Secretary of State, as was James Monroe. But the party machinery and support had kind of run down because of the lack of competition. So William Crawford's challenged by three candidates who were nominated by their state legislatures. One is Henry Clay, the very powerful Speaker of the House from Kentucky. Another is John Quincy Adams, John Adams' son from Massachusetts. By the way, you mentioned before the possibility of passing power on to your son. The only one of the early presidents to have a son was John Adams.
Wow.
So this was controversy on all kinds of levels. And then the fourth candidate was Andrew Jackson, from the hero of the War of 1812 and the Battle of New Orleans, who had been a senator from Tennessee, and he's nominated as the fourth candidate. So you have a fragmented election, and what the turnout, the result is, Jackson wins most of the Electoral College votes and most of the popular votes. John Quincy Adams comes in second. William Crawford comes in third, and Henry Clay comes in fourth. And according to the 12th Amendment, enacted towards the end of Thomas Jefferson's first term, the top three candidates remain in play. And who decides, who makes the final decision, Rick? I'm testing you historically.
I'm going to say the Speaker of the House.
The House of Representatives.
House of Representatives.
And then, you're close. You're close.
I had the right group.
Yeah, I told you to take notes. And the way the Constitution stipulates is that each state kind of caucuses within itself in the House and casts one vote. So Henry Clay is out of it. But remember, Henry Clay is a powerful Speaker of the House.
Right.
So he's got a lot of influence.
That's why I thought, well, he can't pick himself.
He can't pick himself, but he basically is in the catbird seat. He can decide who the next president is. So there's no smoking gun of a formal arrangement, but essentially what happens is he supports John Quincy Adams. John Quincy Adams becomes president, appoints Henry Clay Secretary of State, heretofore the stepping stone to the presidency. Andrew Jackson, the really popular war hero, claims we was robbed. And this is known as the corrupt bargain. There's no evidence that it was officially corrupt.
There's no electronic email papers.
We don't have any tapes or anything like that. There's no tweets or anything that we can look back at. But the fact that Jackson was clearly the most popular candidate at that time made this very controversial. And John Quincy Adams' entire presidency is a continuation of the 1824 election. And by 1828, the Jackson and his supporters have formed the Democratic Party, which wins election in takes control of the presidency, but also control of the Congress in 1828. And they really become the dominant party until the Civil War.
Is there, and because I don't know my history that well,
yeah,
is there an amendment that comes from this that says, hey, this guy won the popular vote and the electoral vote, so that means he wins regardless of what happens? Do we change the format of what happens next?
We don't. There's no formal constitutional amendment. You know, after the election of 1800, we were shipped back in Denver, because there was no mechanism to distinguish between the presidential candidate and the vice presidential candidate, Jefferson and Aaron Burr from New York actually tie, and then the House has to decide which is the lame duck House, has to decide which is controlled by the Federals, which Democratic Republican should become president. So the 12th Amendment's passed after that, so you can distinguish between a president and vice president. Nothing similarly happens after 1828, even though, Rick, Jackson does propose, and this is still controversial, that the Electoral College be eliminated and that the president be elected directly by popular vote. But no amendment like that is passed. But what is established is, for the first time, is the Democratic Party establishes the National Nominating Convention. Again, we talked a little bit about this before, made up of delegates from the state and local level. Jackson said this is a reasonably democratic way to nominate candidates. These people come fresh from the people. And those conventions provide, and then eventually the opposition to the Democrats, those pesky Whigs, which we could talk a little bit more about, which become the opposition to the Jacksonian presidency over the bank issue, they establish a national convention. And that provides enough stability in the nominating process so you don't have fragmentation like this again until the Civil War.
Well, then we move on to 1828 when Andrew Jackson does become president.
Right.
And it's noted in history that he's the first president who wasn't born of privilege.
That's right. Yeah. Jackson is the first outsider to be elected to the presidency. You know, this is such a popular trope in contemporary American politics. But until Jackson became president, most of the people who became president, and many of them Virginians, Virginia was very important, were part of what could be called the inherited leadership of the country. Many of them very important leaders of the Revolutionary War. John Quincy Adams was the first president who really wasn't central to the revolutionary generation. But Jackson is really an outsider, and that adds fuel to his claim that he was robbed of the presidency and adds populist fervor to his campaign in 1828 and also to his presidency.
Was he reelected in 1832?
He sure was. And over the key issue that had divided parties since the beginning of the Republic, the National Bank. The Jeffersonians don't ever kill it off. They consider it a necessary evil. Jacksonians' opponents, who hoped to make the bank an issue in 1832, because it's really popular in Pennsylvania, where the National Bank is, a key state in elections, they rechartered the bank 4 years before it's due to expire. Jackson, in one of the most important vetoes a president's ever made, vetoes the legislation and says, I hope that the people are watching this action and that they will uphold this veto in my run for reelection in 1832. This is the first time, Rick, a president, so to speak, ever goes over the heads of Congress and makes an appeal directly to the people about a public policy issue. And when Jackson is reelected in 1832, even his opposition, then called the Whigs, admit that he's got a mandate that the people have upheld his veto, and the bank is killed off. And we never have another national bank.
What qualifies as a mandate? Because to me, that word means a lot more than 50.5% or 51% or something, which regardless of which political party you take, has been used frequently in the last 10 to 20 years, which is if your party wins, even by a slim margin, you claim to have a mandate.
Yeah. This is, and the Whigs... Maybe you were born to be a Whig, because this is the argument the Whigs make against Jackson. In fact, when Jackson is reelected, he kills off the bank 2 years before it's actually due to expire, and that really arouses the Whigs' opposition in the name of this mandate, and they pass a measure of censure against him, and christen him and this, King Andrew I for this action he's taken. But the Jacksonians argue, Rick, that the majority should rule in American politics. And because Jackson was reelected on the issue of the bank, that he should be given the authority to pursue the killing off of the bank that he began before the election.
We don't even let the majority rule today. You have to have, if you have 55 people as your party in the Senate, it takes 60 to get something done.
Yeah. And there's always been, going back to the beginning of the Republic, how much power a simple majority should have. We've always tried to balance majority rule and individual rights. After all, we have this thing called the court, federal court, which those nine people that are selected. Wouldn't you like one of those jobs?
You know,
selected
actually,
for.
If I knew enough about legalese, I certainly would.
But one point about the at this time in our history, there was a strong commitment to mass democracy, and there was no use of the filibuster in the Senate like there is routinely today in American politics.
Yeah, so even that's changed. The filibuster is just saying, I'm going to do something, and not actually make me do it.
Yeah, that's a relatively recent phenomenon of a routine use of the filibuster, so you need 60% of the vote.
We were talking about how in 1824 there were four candidates.
Right.
And we've talked about third party mentioned several times. A question that says, if a third party formed... let me get this properly, because this looks to be more like a statement than a question. whether if a third party formed, they would view systemic changes in how parties are formed similar to England, and whether they expect coalitions to form from that. Yeah. So if it was possible to get third party candidates, although you mentioned earlier that the financing is probably making that as close to impossible as can be.
And the primaries too, Rick, because the incentives aren't there. Yeah.
Is there a way to make it happen if we remove money? Like, there's always that, do you want to donate a dollar to the election system?
Yeah.
Do you foresee in any possible way that we would come a little bit more like England, where there are multiple parties, each representing a smaller bit of belief?
Yeah, like the Liberal Party now, which is in coalition with the Conservative Party.
Right.
The reason we can't become like England, and again, we could spend a whole show on this, is that we don't have a parliamentary system. So the way England works is you have parliamentary elections, and then the parliamentary the people elected to the parliament bargain about who will be prime minister, unless there's one clear majority party that selects the prime minister. We have a presidential system. And although we have a Congress, and I guess you could form coalitions in Congress, because of the big prize being the presidency, that kind of detracts from the kind of bargains and forming a coalition government like one we'll see in a parliamentary system like the UK or Israel, which I think has like 400 parties.
Professor Sidney Milk is with us today as we talk about some interesting elections in history and exactly how they played such a big cause and effect on what's happening today. 11:37. Be right back.
Our members are joined by the following underwriters in their support of WNRN.
Paragon Day Spa, the down-to-earth spa. Paragon Day Spa offers massage, facials, electrolysis, waxing, and natural nails. Paragon Day Spa takes an all-natural approach where the focus is on you and offers skincare and day spa services. For more information, ParagonDaySpa.com. Paragon Day Spa, 1706 Emmett Street, Charlottesville.
The Markets of Tiger Fuel Company. Homegrown since 1982, you can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street.
Hello, I'm Audrey Hawkins from the Rockbridge Christmas Basket Program. Since 1949, our nonprofit organization has delivered Christmas cheer and goodwill to needy families in Lexington, Rockbridge County, and Buena Vista. Every year, we serve over 1,000 families with food and toys to ensure everyone has a happy holiday season. We are looking for volunteers to assist us to pack boxes of food and bags of toys and to help clean up afterwards. Packing day is scheduled for Saturday, December 20th, from 8 a.m. until noon at the Howard P. Anderson Arena at the Virginia Horse Center. Everyone is invited to participate. We are also looking for financial donations to fund our project. For more information, you can write to us, rockbridgechristmasbasket@gmail.com. I'm Audrey Hawkins, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection@WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks for being with us today here on WNRN. Our guest who's with us today is University of Virginia Professor of Politics, Sidney Milkus. He's traveling through time with us and teaching us some important political facts that aren't just, we're not just watching MSNBC and Fox News banter back and forth about what's actually should be important. So let's jump into, actually, you know, let's do this real quick. I want to talk about some of the off-year elections.
Sure.
For just a moment. You sent me a couple. You sent me 1958, 2010, and 1994.
Right. Those are all really.
So let's do our best to go
through all of them
properly in time. So 1958.
Properly in time. All right. 1958, Dwight Eisenhower is president in his second term. But there's a very, and he's a very popular president, perhaps one of the most popular presidents since the Second World War. But there's a very bad recession in 58, and the Democrats do extremely well in that off-year election and take a strong command of both the House and the Senate. And what's particularly important about that election is until 1958, the Democratic Party in the Congress was strongly divided between the Southern Democrats. Remember when there were Southern Democrats?
Yes,
There were decidedly until the 1990s, and the more liberal Democrats from the Northeast and the coasts. But this great Democratic victory in 58 shifts the gravity decidedly in the direction of the liberal wing of the party in the Congress. They formed the Democratic Study Group, which is a kind of a vanguard of liberal policies, in the Congress, and this is sort of the beginning of this sort of a precursor to what's going to happen in the 1960s, when Lyndon Johnson particularly gets great support from a Democratic Congress in bringing about the Great Society. So that's a really important election in the development of the Great Society and the expansion of liberalism during those years.
Now you mentioned how that is in the off-year election of Eisenhower's second term.
Right. So always a bad time. A lot of times a bad time for presidents.
Right. That has been mentioned many, many times over the past past year or so in anticipation and in follow-up of what just happened to President Obama's second year off-term election.
Right, right.
So this is not it didn't take us to a bad place to have this happen.
Right. This is the rule rather than the exception. That is usually presidents in their second term. Their party does badly.
What happens? Just as a, you know, I don't know if it's an easy answer or not. But what happens in the presidential election following that? Do we always switch parties?
Not always, but that can, particularly in the 19th century, it seemed to be an important trend in the switch in parties. But that's when presidential and congressional elections were more in tandem. That is to say, there are good turnouts for both.
Right.
Now we have this, we have pretty substantial drop-offs.
Well, that's when we also had the Democratic-Republican Party were all as one,
at least
for part of the century.
That's right, yeah. So it doesn't always indicate that, but it can be an important.
So what should be my Las Vegas bet as the Democratic or Republican presidential winner in 2016?
Yeah, I would not bet on that election.
Save my dollar?
I would save your dollars. Because the country is, in a way that it hasn't been split since the end of the 19th century, is split badly. And it's very difficult to see who's going to emerge in 2016. I will say this. In recent elections, the demographics of the off-year elections have favored Republicans. The demographic of presidential elections have favored Democrats. So if you really want to bet, Rick. If you have this obsession
sometimes
with gambling and you can't get counseling about it before 2016, I'd put your money on somebody like Hillary Clinton would not be a bad bet.
If you ask certain people, they might say. all right, so let's jump ahead to 1994.
Yeah, 1994 is a really important indicator that
it's an off-year election, but it's not even term of President Clinton's off year.
Yeah, which and remember, it's not just in the second term that a president's party can suffer badly in an off year election. And healthcare has been a really controversial issue in American politics.
Gosh, for 20 years
since at least going back to the New Deal, really. But it really heats up during the Clinton presidency, and the Clinton's failed at effort to get healthcare through both.
What is it with Democrats who want everybody to be as healthy and covered for their major expenses as?
What is it with Democrats?
Yeah, why is it?
We're getting into a philosophical discussion.
All right,
they feel that if you don't have access to health care, you can't be a free individual. That kind of presents such a a kind of unstable dimension of your life that one can't say that you're a free man or woman. As FDR put it, you know, the first great defender of the welfare state, necessitous men and women are not free men and women. Men and women who don't have health care, the Democrats argue, are necessitous in a way that deprives them of freedom.
Yeah, we'll have
that would be a whole show. We could do that.
We'll have Carolyn Engelhardt back on the program in January to talk about the Affordable Care Act and where that's going.
But conservatives believe, you know, that this undermines individual responsibility. I think that's a great constitutional debate. Clinton lost that debate in 92. He infuriated conservatives. He disappointed liberals. And so the Republicans, led by this guy Newt Gingrich, who kind of organizes the Republicans for that campaign, particularly in the House, win control of both houses of Congress. It's the first time that the Republicans take control of the House in 42 years, going back to 1952, the Eisenhower election in 1952. And what's really important in my mind about this election, Rick, is it shows the Reagan Revolution is not limited, Reagan Revolution as it's called, by many people, is not limited to the presidency. Reagan won in 1980, and thereafter Republicans do very well for a time at the presidential level, but they never take control of the Congress till 1994. Unfortunately for them, they don't have control of the presidency, and Clinton kind of fights back against Gingrich on the matter of whether the government should be shut down. Where have we heard this before?
Mm.
And he's reelected in 1996.
Yes, we do seem to have a lot of repetitious conversations.
Yeah. So the important part of the 94 election is it shows that the Republican strength goes well beyond Ronald Reagan.
11:46 here, talking with Professor Sidney Milkus about some really fascinating political history. I always find this important to look back and see what happened then.
I hope my students are listening to you, Rick, because I like that adjective. That adjective, fascinating, is not one that's often applied to my lecture.
Well, let's go to one more of these off your elections, 2010 and the Tea Party.
Yeah, well, this one most of our listeners will know very well, remember well. The major issue is the health care. Unlike President Clinton, President Obama gets it through. He gets the Affordable Care Act through, but it's very controversial. And that combined with the stubborn tumor of unemployment, which is bad when President Obama is elected, 7% in 2008, it's up to about 10% in 2010. So that leads to the Republicans winning some 60 votes in the 2010 election, and on the ground, in a sense, pushing that momentum for the Republicans is this new faction of the Republican Party, the Tea Party, which is dedicated to making the Republican Party more conservative than it had been up to this time, more strongly in opposition to things like the Affordable Care Act. And I think that this is, in a sense, changes the dynamic of President Obama's presidency. What looked like it was going to be a transformational presidency, which really revitalized a kind of progressive consensus in American politics, very quickly evaporates into a ferociously split country, and the country remains split as we approach the 2016 election.
Do you think that the Tea Party, as its segment of the Republican Party, what do you think the percentage chance, the likelihood is of that causing a split like we saw in earlier centuries where I think everyone's sort of having a hard time getting their head around the Democratic/Republican Party all being one and things happening to lead them to diversify. What do you think the Tea Party's chances of causing that similar
causing a fragmentation? I think the split between the Tea Party and what are called the more establishment Republicans, although these are so-called establishment Republicans like John Brain are pretty conservative. They're not quite as
Lindsey Graham.
They're willing to support things like immigration reform, for example, which I think is going to be. And President Obama's kind of tossed the ball into the or batted the ball into the Republican court.
He threw the dog treat into the pile of hungry dogs.
Yeah, that's one. Being from Philly, I wouldn't have thought of that one, Rick. But that's now the fault line in the Republican Party. And I think as we approach the 2016 campaign, we can see. I think that's something that more Tea Party-oriented candidates like Rand Paul and more establishment candidates will fight over in the 2016 primaries.
Professor Sidney Milk is here as we talk about elections, 1149. If you have a question, you just want to pass it through 434-979-0919. History doesn't always need questions, except about tell us what happened.
Sure, we always have to interrogate him.
Yes. are you right with that story about elections? Yeah. Wait. We could always say, yeah. See, I can get off topic
again. Milk is doing truth or fiction.
I can always get off topic again now and start talking about historical high school textbooks.
Yeah, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. Yes. So some of this may sound crazy, but so I think most of this is true.
1932, the election of 1932. Yeah. You highlighted that as something that really a vital election in the last 100 years.
Yeah. I think it's really important because before this, one could say that America was committed to what a lot of people refer to as natural rights, that rights preceded government, and government's basic responsibility should be limited, and the leading principle in the country should be individual responsibility, what Herbert Hoover called rugged individualism when he was elected in 1928. And that is challenged some in the progressive era by presidents like Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, but it really doesn't. It really isn't trumped in an important way until the 1932 election, and of course, driven by the Great Depression. I mean, we've witnessed the Great Recession, and what was unemployment got up to 7-10%. That's terrible. It's been bad economic times. Well, in 1932, when Franklin Roosevelt beats the incumbent president Herbert Hoover, unemployment is about one-third of the country. In major cities, Rick, well over half of the labor force is unemployed. All the banks are shut down. We thought we had a bank crisis in 2008. We did, but nothing like we saw in 1932, where all the banks were pretty much shut down. So given the conditions of the country, which Hoover is blamed for, Roosevelt wins a pretty substantial landslide, he and the Democrats, in 1932. And then we get the New Deal. We get the foundations of the welfare state. The core of that is the Social Security Bill, which is enacted in 1935. And I would just say that 32 is important because that's kind of a rejection of Hoover. 36 confirms the policies and the principles that Roosevelt stands for. He runs against this guy Alf Landon from Kansas, who's pretty moderate, actually, but calls for the repeal of the Social Security Act, just as Mitt Romney called for the repeal of the Affordable Care Act in 2012. Well, Roosevelt wins an overwhelming landslide, the biggest to this point in our history, wins 60% of the vote. Every state but Maine and Vermont.
Now, that's a mandate.
That's a mandate. And, you know, before this, Rick, it was said that as goes Maine, so goes the country, because it was considered a bellwether. Where after this, they say, as goes Maine, so goes Vermont. And my favorite quip about this election is somebody who, you know, Alf Landon was sort of charismatically challenged. And somebody said if he had made one more speech in that campaign, Roosevelt would have won Canada. So that was an overwhelming election. It kind of consolidates the New Deal as a central part of our political system. And it really isn't challenged, Rick, until Ronald Reagan's election in 1980.
And the 32 election also seems to bring about these different groups mm-hmm. that become the makeup of mm-hmm. the current mm-hmm. Democratic Party. You've got, let me check my notes here, urban workers,
right.
Northern African Americans, Jewish voters, mm-hmm. Different coalitions that make up what many people would say, oh, that's your ethnic or, that's your gender background, then that's who you vote for.
Yeah.
That's a basic rule of stereotype.
Yeah. And this began to come together in 1912 with the Progressive Party, but it really takes more definitive shape in 1932. And as you say, as you put it very well, this kind of coalition of ethnic minorities, urban workers, many of whom were ethnic minorities, African Americans, and what we call the chatting class. That is a lot of academics, and professionals become a part of the Democratic Party at this time.
I hadn't heard
sometimes
that before.
Called the quiche crowd,
the chatting class. The chatting. I like that.
Well, we do like to chat, Rick. You know, actually, African Americans who had supported the Party of Lincoln since the Civil War, they don't shift in 1932 till they see what the New Deal's about. And even though the FDR does not pursue a civil rights program, the economic reforms he pursues are attractive to African Americans, and they shift historically in 1936. As one of their leaders said, turn Lincoln's picture to the wall. It's time for us to support the Democratic Party.
Well, let's jump forward. We only have got about 5 minutes left.
Boy, time flies when you're
Well, you know, when you're flying through time.
When you're flying through time. Yeah,
Next time I'm going to need a chair because I'm getting a little dizzy.
But 11, I'm sitting in a chair and I'm dizzy, Rick.
11:55 with Professor Sidney Milkins as we talk about some of the forgotten yet important elections in the history of the United States. You've mentioned it several times, the election of 1980 and Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, I think it's a really important election because even though since the New Deal, we'd had Republican presidents. I mentioned Eisenhower, Nixon, Ford. None of those Republican presidents really took on the New Deal directly. It was considered so popular that one didn't really challenge it. One didn't particularly challenge Social Security, which had come to be considered an entitlement in American politics. The first president to really challenge the idea of the New Deal is Ronald Reagan. He's really the one who brings a powerful conservative wing of the party into power. This wing begins to take flight with Barry Goldwater's campaign in 64, but of course Goldwater loses a landslide election to Lyndon Johnson. Well, Ronald Reagan shows that conservative movement has now come into fruition. His famous line in the inauguration, see if I can get this right, in this crisis, because we had very bad economic conditions at the end of the 70s, government is not the solution to our crisis. In this particular moment, government is the crisis. That is a revolutionary line which suggests that the commitment, the strong consensus for the New Deal liberal welfare state has cracked. And although I don't think this inaugurates a conservative political era, it inaugurates a strongly divided political system where liberals and conservatives fight pretty ferociously over what the appropriate principles and policies of government should be.
Many people talk about how in our current political system, it's difficult to become president or run for office. The larger and more grand the office that you choose to run for, we're getting more mild candidates because when people start vetting you and checking in your background, you may find mistakes. But does Reagan bring about the entertainment value and need and importance of the candidate because he was an entertainer?
Yeah, I think Reagan is really one of the reasons that he triumphs. There's all kinds of reasons why Goldwater failed and Reagan succeeded. The times had changed dramatically. But I think that's a good point, Rick. I think Reagan, a former actor, was very comfortable with television and personality, image politics, and exploited it. This really began, of course, Rick, with John Kennedy in 1960, but it takes on a more ideological thrust with Ronald Reagan, and he combines this personality politics with a kind of really important programmatic ambition. And I think President Obama, with the use of the pioneering use of the Internet, and his ambition to revitalize progressivism, particularly with healthcare reform, has advanced our politics once again with respect to a combination of technological innovation and programmatic ambition.
What do you see, again, just a few minutes left, Les Temps-Perdue will be up in about 90 seconds. Yeah. So as we finish up our travel through time, let's take a step forward if we can. And what do you see being an important aspect of a future presidential election?
What dimensions would be important?
Mm-hmm.
I think that one thing we ought to revisit is our campaign finance laws, which have become, I think, extremely controversial and mischievous, I think.
Well, you mentioned earlier, would I want to be one of those nine on the Supreme Court? But they've made their decision.
And
Which is why, yes, I would want to be on the Supreme
Court. Some of the campaign finance laws have contributed this to this as well. And a lot of the money now is being spent by groups and individuals outside of the parties. And we don't really know where this money's coming from. And so I think this does great damage to American democracy. I also think we have to figure out a way, Rick, to reengage the American people in American politics. Both Ronald Reagan and President Obama, if I can be nonpartisan about this, good way to end, have showed promise to do that. But still, in presidential elections, we're lucky if we get 55% of the vote. And in the last off-year election, the 2014 election, we had only 37%.
Do you think that's, and real quick, this has to be my last question.
Yeah.
Do you think
you keep promising these
are
your last.
Do you think that this is because of the, you use the word ferocity in argument, or is this because of what I mentioned earlier is the lack of a quality candidate because of the vetting, et cetera?
I think it's hard to get to appear to be a quality candidate with this ferocious split we have in the country right now. So I think that is one thing. I think people are very turned off by it. And I think the other thing is that our politics has gotten too presidency and personality centered. You know, it used to be that things like city councils and state legislatures were really important to people. And I'd like to see, we should do a program on local politics sometime and their importance.
You are always welcome back.
Okay. At least about once every couple of months, anyway. I always enjoy it, Rick.
Thank you very much. Professor Sidney Milk is with us here today. Show will be put up on podcast, cvillepodcast.com and wnrn.org. Next week, we will be certainly talking about current events, which will mean what's happening at the University of Virginia. Graylin Brashear will be here from, that'll be fascinating. Les Temps Perdue up next. Sorry for taking over that extra minute, Drew Thompson.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong
and Max Cecilia Struther.
Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.